Public radio is here for you. It doesn't matter how old you are, how big your home is, or what kind of car you drive. WOSU and NPR connect you to news and information in civil conversations. That's why 43 million Americans listen to NPR each week. WOSU is part of our community, covering and discussing issues important to you, standing with the facts. Meet the moment with WOSU. Go to WOSU.org/protect.
Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich. The U.S. Supreme Court has released a number of consequential rulings this term. The cases have major effects on the creation and maintenance of policy across the country in the face of a rapidly changing social landscape. One such ruling was the case of Mahmoud v. Taylor, and it could have a major impact on the teaching of LGBTQ issues in schools. In the case, a divided Supreme Court said religious parents can pull their children from class if a lesson uses an LGBTQ-themed story. Joining me to discuss this decision is Mark Spindleman, a professor of law at Ohio State University, specializing in constitutional law and social justice. Mark's scholarship broadly focuses on questions of sexuality, reproduction, death, and love as they intersect with law, society, and culture. Mark, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me on.
So let's do some background on this Mahmoud v. Taylor case. It involves a case that was brought by parents in Maryland, and it was basically the parents versus the school district. Do I have that part right?
Yeah.
Okay, so this case dates back to 2022, and the district created lessons involving storybooks, and they said that they were doing it to reflect the district's diversity. So these books included LGBTQ stories. And at first, parents were allowed to opt out, but then the district said that became disruptive, so later there was no opting out. And that's how the court case started. Is that right?
Yeah. So there were conversations in this very diverse school district in Montgomery County, Maryland, and the district recognized that there were different kinds of diversity that the school was addressing through classroom instruction, and some kinds like LGBTQ plus focused instruction that was not being reflected as part of the wider community's diversity in the classroom. And the idea was to sort of have some of that be reflected.
Okay. So but basically some parents, citing religious reasons, said that they didn't want their students reading these books that maybe had two dads in it or two moms or other LGBTQ themes.
Yeah. So the parents who were the main plaintiffs in the cases you noted before complained that the inclusion of these books in the classroom, plus, you know, some of the instruction sort of that might be provided around them, was inconsistent with the parents' religious beliefs and the ways that they wanted to bring up their children. And that inconsistency, they said, violated their religious liberty and their rights as parents to inculcate their religious beliefs in their children.
Now, did they want the lessons to stop, or did they just want to be able to opt out?
Well, in the court decision itself, the focus was on the opt-out question. Mm-hmm. Separate question about whether, sort of as a matter of school board policy, they might have preferred to not have the education, the sort of LGBTQ-focused education through these books provided at all. But the Supreme Court's decision was about sort of the inability of the parents to opt out of this kind of instruction for their kids.
And the district must have known this was going to be a problem if they had an opt-out provision at the beginning, I guess.
Yeah, the district had was aware that there were a range of views mm-hmm. on the question, but then sort of had this experience that you were describing with the policy, first trying it one way and then trying it another way, sort of after that became challenging. And the idea was, you know, sort of an ongoing conversation and experiment sort of with the education, in the sense of that, you know, all education is experimental, but, mm-hmm. you know, sort of in that sense.
Okay. So they basically, the district was saying that they wanted to reflect the diversity of the district by including books. And I'm sure it's not just LGBTQ books. I'm sure they included books about different races and cultures. I mean, I don't know everything that was discussed, but I guess the LGBTQ related books are what caused the court case.
Yeah, that's right.
Okay, so what was the actual question before the court? You said it was religious freedom?
Yeah, it's a religious freedom claim sort of that's bound up with a claim of parental rights to bring one's children up sort of in one's faith. And the idea was that the school district policy was operating not merely to expose the children to the kinds of diversity reflected in the books that the court was talking about, books that talked about same-sex love, that talked about trans identity in different kinds of ways, but not just sort of to expose the children to those ideas, but in a way that, given the non-opt-out possibility, wound up, in a sense, being more coercive than otherwise would have been the case if they had, you know, sort of been able to opt out. So they said, we ought to be able, you know, sort of to take our children, opt out of this particular instruction so that the children, in a sense, aren't getting confused. These are, you know, not sort of older children, but, you know, sort of so the children wouldn't get confused about sort of what the belief structure was and what right and wrong in the parents' view was consistent with their religious views.
Was this, I guess, as far as the Supreme Court is concerned, they don't care which religion, but was it a particular religion that these parents, or was it a group of parents and many?
Different parents, different religious faiths.
Oh, so there's multiple, even though it's just one name gets put on the case, it's multiple parents?
Yeah.
Is that right? Okay. So are we talking like Roman Catholic and I don't know what else?
Yeah, I mean, sort of, it wasn't, yeah. So the litigators sort of behind the case were sort of, you know, good litigators in making sure that it wasn't just one religion, but it was sort of folks from different faith communities who had similar converging beliefs around questions of sex, sexuality, and gender.
Now, obviously, before this went to the Supreme Court, lower courts made rulings. So is that how it ended up at the Supreme Court?
Yeah. So, you know, sort of the lower courts sort of make their rulings, and then the losing party has a chance to try to bring the case up to the Supreme Court. And so this one had worked its way through the lower courts, you know, all the way up to the Supreme Court, sort of that. And then the court decided the case sort of not, you know, formally it's really about, you know, sort of this particular school district in Maryland, but, you know, sort of the implications given the constitutional protections for religious freedom and parental rights that the case involves really has much wider implications than just for the one school district.
Okay. So what did the Supreme Court decide in this case?
So there's a technical question about sort of, you know, procedural matters and injunctive relief, but sort of the deeper issue that that the court sort of put its thumb down on the scale of was just this religious freedom and parental rights claim. The idea that sort of the school district, under the circumstances of the case, without allowing for the parental opt-outs, took steps that were inconsistent with the parents' religious liberty and their ability to sort of give their children the kind of religious instruction without sort of substantial interference from the state.
So they ruled, basically they ruled against the school district and said there has to be an opt-out.
Against the school district on the side of the opt-out.
Okay, but they didn't say the school district can't do these lessons.
At this point, no. That was not, you know, the question. You know, there's this deeper question that the case raises, you know, sort of, but certainly as a matter of school board policy, but sort of on the sort of posture of the case, how the case came up and was decided, it's really the question of the opt-out in a district that decides to go ahead and have this kind of instruction.
And now, is this one of those cases that can have broader implications? So any school district anywhere where a parent says that a lesson is against my religious beliefs, they can now, they need an opt-out.
So the case is about and focuses on, you know, sort of education sort of at the elementary level. And the court's opinion in the case makes clear that the kinds of judgments that it's issuing about the ways in which school board policy and education sort of shapes a child in school is in part a function of children's age and their capacity to process and to sort of understand, well, this is what's being taught in school, this is what my parents are saying, you know, sort of to see the difference. So there is a wider potential application of the rules that sort of and the principles that come out of this case to other school districts sort of that are and sort of at that same level. The bigger question is really how far reaching is this decision going to be? What kinds of new requirements might it prefigure, might it sort of suggest will be coming down the pike from the court in the future that sort of widen, in a sense, the religious liberty and parents' rights claims as a kind of constitutional challenge to school board policymaking around what, you know, I think is fair to say is a, you know, progressive, you know, sort of LGBTQ plus inclusive curriculum.
Okay. So, but just like bottom line from this one ruling, does each school district have to have an opt-out policy on certain lessons?
Well, I mean, school districts that don't have opt-out policies on lessons under circumstances like these, you know, sort of are certainly going to be giving, you know, if they do have an opt-out don't have an opt-out policy, they may be
they're opening themselves up to potential litigation.
Yeah, they may be in the process right now of reconsidering that in light of the case. So a case like this will come down, and you know, sort of it then in a sense gets processed institutionally in all of these really interesting and complicated ways, trying to figure out sort of how broad it is, how narrow it is, what the meaning for different school districts is, and then sort of you begin to see policy changes sort of that are responsive to those understandings of the decision. So there's the sort of the decision and then its immediate wake, but then there's the potential in future cases that get brought, maybe in relation to some school districts that don't sort of modify their policies, or school districts that have policies that they think come within the four corners of this decision, meaning that they're acceptable sort of under the ideas that Mahmoud sets forth. But it turns out Mahmoud stands perhaps for a broader principle. So there's likely to be future litigation, and there's a reasonable chance, a reasonable possibility that future litigation will, in a sense, widen the scope of the court's decision. So maybe it's not only sort of about young kids in elementary school, you know, sort of how far it goes and sort of in what age areas it goes. So we're going to be watching sort of over the course of the next number of years to see what additional developments come in this decision's wake.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how recent Supreme Court decisions could impact LGBTQ youth in Ohio with Ohio State University law professor Mark Spindelman. So this case that we're talking about dates back to 2022. During that time, there was a lot of talk of diversity, equity, and inclusion efforts. They were gaining a lot of steam all around the country. So now, because of efforts with the Trump administration at the federal level, a lot of these DEI programs have been pulled back. So in this day and age, in 2025, do you think this case would even exist now? Do you think that a school district would have such a specifically diverse lesson?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. You know, if the world weren't what it is, if this case weren't what it is, what would happen?
I'm making you be hypothetical.
I mean, you know, sort of setting this case aside, you know, sort of I think it requires some real thinking through about what the relationship is between DEI, sort of anti-DEI policy of the sort that you were describing coming out of the president's administration, and then other sort of levels of government as well, how that anti-DEI sort of thinking affects or shapes policies like this that are about classroom education. So, you know, sort of that's a challenging question. If the question is, do the values of inclusiveness that of the sort that drove this policy into creation, the one that the court put into question the way that it did, the values, I think, likely persist in school districts in different places across the state of Ohio and elsewhere, that inclusiveness value. How that then sort of lines up against sort of the anti-DEI thinking, sentiment, policymaking is a slightly different angle of vision onto what's happening here, you know, sort of situated in the context of sort of classroom instruction. Mm-hmm. So I think the values persist. And so if we set this case aside, sort of would those values translate? Perhaps. But the translation of those values into policy, the translation mm-hmm. Of inclusiveness values to reflect a community and its membership, the translation of those values into education policy certainly now has to take account of what the Mahmood decision says on a going forward basis. So, you know, sort of it may not be permissible for some certain impulses, some certain community values to now be reflected in education policy, like in this instance, the no opt-out provision. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I think that the values persist, but they now can only be implemented consistent with this kind of new ruling.
Hmm. And what about the broader implications here of parents' rights? Because you said that that plays into here, too. What if they don't want their kids to learn about other things? What if they don't want their kids to learn about certain parts of American history?
Yeah, so this is a point that the dissenting opinion in the case raises as a point of objection against the majority, that the kinds of grounds for parental objections that the court credits in Mahmood raise the potential for other kinds of parental objections to different aspects of the curriculum. And I think what's going to happen is we'll see, mm-hmm. You know, sort of what sorts of claims do and don't get made, you know, and how then the lower courts reading Mahmood respond. But here the Supreme Court is quite sensitive to the claims of religious freedom and the rights of parents to bring their children up in their faith without, as the court is seeing it, being unduly interfered or substantially interfered with in those constitutional promises. And we'll see what the court thinks about how broad that principle is, if it's limited to LGBTQ plus curriculum, or if this is, in a sense, just the leading edge of a range of claims that may be coming down the pike. And then we'll see how the court sort of sees them as similar or dissimilar in the future cases that I think, you know, it's reasonable to expect we'll see before too long.
But this also makes me think about teaching evolution in science class, because that would be against certain religions to believe in evolution. And so could you have your kid opt out of a high school biology class where you're learning about evolution?
Well, I mean, again, high school.
You don't know. Yeah.
Again, high school.
High school.
So,
okay.
You know, sort of. And then there's this question. So this case, you know, sort of to the extent that this decision is really sort of structured around the justices in the majority sense of the how impressionable young children are.
So this is structured around elementary.
Yeah. And so, okay. You know, sort of what then happens at sort of higher levels of education as children's capacity sort of to process information and to think about it and reflect on it and to, you know, sort of have conversations about it. As that changes, then the scope of the parental rights may be different sort of in that different context. Whether it will or won't be, you know, sort of stay tuned. But for now, you know, sort of we haven't gotten to that question yet, but you're right to sort of raise it as a question about where the case in principle could go.
Hmm. Well, we are talking today with Ohio State University law professor Mark Spindelman. And Mark is staying with us because coming up, we're going to talk about another Supreme Court case. This one was dealing with bans on gender-affirming care. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The fight over transgender rights is one of the most controversial cultural battles in American society today. One case recently decided by the Supreme Court, the United States versus Scrimeti, struck a blow to the push to expand access to gender-affirming care. This decision will have far-reaching implications across the country as lawmakers react to this ruling and create new policies. Still with me is Mark Spindelman, professor of law at Ohio State University, specializing in constitutional law and social justice. Mark's scholarship broadly focuses on questions of sexuality, reproduction, death, and love as they intersect with law, society, and culture. Thanks again for being here, Mark.
Thanks for having me around.
All right. So in this case, Scrimeti v. the United States, the courts were looking at a ban on gender-affirming medical care for transgender minors in Tennessee. The parents who brought the case said that the same medications that were being banned were also used for other medical conditions. So, Mark, can you pick it up from there? Basically, the parents were saying they were not being treated equally with these medications for their kids.
Yeah. So the Supreme Court takes up in Scrimeti the equality-based challenges to the Tennessee law. There were two main equality challenges. One challenge was grounded in the idea that Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth constituted a form of impermissible sex discrimination. Under Supreme Court cases, generally widely prohibiting sex discrimination by the government. The other argument, main equality argument, that the court takes up is an argument that says that the Tennessee law constituted a form of what one might call standalone anti-transgender discrimination. And the idea here, sort of in part, was that transgender people are a kind of distinctive group, mm-hmm. like others that have been recognized, that is entitled to a kind of distinctive judicial supervision of laws that discriminate on the basis of this group's status. So transgender-based discrimination, the argument was, calls for judges to look at laws that engage in this kind of discrimination mm-hmm. with some skepticism, in part because the political processes, the idea goes, may not be trusted as they ordinarily are to treat certain groups. The one way of describing them is in formal legal terms as a discrete and insular minority, mm-hmm. With a kind of ordinary fair break that people are thought to be entitled to in terms of getting their views and values and voices heard. So the idea here was transgender folks constitute an unusual or a suspect or a quasi-suspect classification where laws discriminating against them trigger a closer judicial look to see if the reasons for the legislation are really neutral and valid, or whether they smack of an unconstitutional bias or taint or effort to discriminate against the class, if they're sort of driven by some sort of illicit purpose. Those are the two main equality arguments that the court takes up in Scrimeti. And the majority opinion by Chief Justice John Roberts mm-hmm. says no and no. Mm-hmm. The law, he says, does not discriminate on the basis of sex in the ways that our past mm-hmm. cases have held, nor is this even a form of anti-trans discrimination. So we don't even have to look at the kind of deeper next level legal question of whether this is the right kind of group to call upon us to give laws like SB 1 a kind of distinctive judicial fly-specking, a kind of judicial second look. Mm. And the law, he says, involves not those kinds of discrimination, but just age restrictions. It's about youth. And also medical use restrictions of the sort that you were describing before. Mm-hmm. And those are not distinctions in the law that ordinarily raise any suspicions of, sort of not fair dealing. And so we just presume the law under these circumstances is constitutional, so long as there's a legitimate basis for enacting it. And you have that aplenty, says the Chief Justice's opinion. Therefore, the law stands.
Okay, so... So when you say the law stands, the ban on gender-affirming care for minors stands?
Correct.
Okay. Just clarifying.
Yep. Nope.
Because it's like double negatives.
Yeah. Sorry.
Okay. So now the Chief Justice wrote in his opinion, which I found interesting, is that he was not actually ruling on bans on gender-affirming care. He said in his opinion that it's not the court's job to judge the wisdom and fairness of the Tennessee law. It is only the court's job to determine whether... the law violates constitutional guarantees of equal protection under the law.
Yeah.
So, okay. So, like, dig into that a little bit. So, they weren't actually ruling on whether the Tennessee law was wise and fair.
Yeah. So part of what the Chief Justice, I take it, is saying, sort of in the language that that you just shared, is that the job of the Supreme Court justices is not to measure the constitutionality of a law like the Tennessee law. It's called SB 1, sort of in shorthand, Senate Bill 1.
Oh, SB 1 has all other implications.
I know.
Ohio,
so that's why I've been trying to avoid. Right, exactly. So the Tennessee law. So in this instance, what he's saying is we don't judge the constitutionality of a law like the one before us from Tennessee on the basis of our sense of whether this is wise or not. That's not the measure of constitutionality. We look to the Constitution and our, sort of the methods that we employed for ascertaining and its meaning when we're asked to rule on the constitutionality of a measure like this. It's a sort of resonant statement that he offered that you just shared. But it's very kind of standard as a way of understanding what the undertaking of the Supreme Court reviewing legislation for constitutionality is and what it's not about. They're not up there sort of having a super duper vote and they say, this is a dumb policy, therefore it's struck down, or I like this one, you win. It's not like that, he's saying. The way that this is we undertake a distinctive kind of analysis of laws and governmental policies as justices of the Supreme Court. And that's what we're doing here, he says.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how recent Supreme Court decisions could affect LGBTQ youth with Ohio State University Law Professor Mark Spindleman. So what does this mean for other states such as Ohio that have passed bans on gender-affirming care, but the ban has been held up in court for months and months? Does this mean that Ohio's ban can stand?
Well, sort of the decision, again, applies sort of in the case at hand. Mm-hmm. But the principles and the rules and the reasons that Chief Justice Roberts gives for upholding Tennessee's ban are reasons that transcend Scrimeti, transcend the case that was before the court. So part of my reluctance here is, sort of, and on that level, it looks like laws from other jurisdictions doing the same sort of thing for the same sort of reasons, sort of should in principle get the same kind of treatment. There is, however, sort of the possibility that the legislation from other jurisdictions might be situated, sort of have arisen in a different kind of way. But it looks like the strong odds are that this is a decision of wider applicability. It is worth noting, however, that the decision, as well as some of the at least one of the other opinions concurring in the case, leaves open the possibility for future kinds of challenges to laws that discriminate against transgender people. But here it's important to remember that the Chief Justice's position in this case was strikingly that this law that was about blocking trans youth from getting gender-affirming medical care that was medically indicated, that this law is itself a law that doesn't involve anti-trans discrimination. Mm-hmm. And the way that the court goes about it is it uses some very lawyerly logic that's, you know, sort of what some people might refer to, I of course would not, as pretzel logic. It's sort of hard to square. But the idea here is in part that the sort of legal sense of what constitutes anti-transgender discrimination may be different than the kind of common sense understanding of what anti-trans discrimination looks like. Although I suspect that lots of readers of the Chief Justice's opinion, when they get around to that part of the opinion describing the Tennessee law barring trans youth from getting gender-affirming medical care is not involving anti-trans discrimination, may find themselves scratching their head.
Okay. We're running out of time, but so this doesn't just impact Ohio. There's about 25 states that have bans on gender-affirming care. But is it, as of today, right now, in Ohio, since Ohio's ban is in the court, that's still not in effect then, because despite the Supreme Court case, we have to have the Ohio case go through the process?
Yeah, so there'll be a process for, again, sort of in a sense processing sort of this new decision that came down and figuring out what its implications are to cases, sort of in other jurisdictions that have already had some preliminary rules. But if the reasons for the rulings in those cases sort of don't square up with the reasons for the majority's position upholding Tennessee's ban, then the lower court judges, in a sense, now have to sort of conform the rules and reasons of their opinions and their decisions in cases about similar legislation in other states to what sort of the Supreme Court has now said.
Hmm. And just quickly, in the dissenting opinion, which was a rare dissent for Justice Sonia Sotomayor, she read her dissent from the bench. She said that giving states the rights here are hauntingly familiar to Virginia banning interracial marriage in 1967. What do you make of that?
Well, so Justice Sotomayor has been writing a number of dissents. What's unusual, as you said, is, you know, sort of that she, this reading from the bench is sort of a sign of a particular kind of intensity. There are different ways of understanding the loving or the analogies between trans discrimination claims and race discrimination claims. And so there's quite a lot to unpack in that kind of analogy.
And I'm going to make you do it in like 2 minutes.
Yeah. So that Justice Sotomayor is offering. I think one way to understand it, by no means the only way, is that the process of recognizing the harms of laws like Virginia's miscegenation ban took quite a long time before the Supreme Court got around to striking those bans down. The Supreme Court's decision, famous decision in Brown against Board of Education on school segregation with its grand race equality commitments, came down in, you know, just before the mid-1950s. And it wasn't until later in the 1960s when the Supreme Court got around to striking down the laws that still remained on the books barring interracial marriage. There was a long process of development throughout the nation sort of on the question of the sort of real meaning of the Constitution's promises of race equality. And part of, I take it, what Justice Sotomayor is talking about is we now understand that the commitments that the Constitution contains and that we as a people have to racial equality include thinking that laws barring interracial marriage are unconstitutional. And that it may take time, in a sense, but Justice Sotomayor is already seeing, in a sense, ahead in the developments, and she's concerned about where the majority is and how it's not recognizing the sort of actual parallels that exist. She thinks it's already time now to be taking that evolutionary process and then enforcing it through a ruling that would have presumably struck down laws like Tennessee's banning gender-affirming medical care, as well as from other jurisdictions.
Mm. Okay, so you're saying like it took 10 to 20 years for the courts to catch up in some of these race cases, so it could be 10 to 20 years in different transgender cases.
Yeah, these are big sort of questions about sort of fundamental values in society. In this case, focused on the meaning of equality values. And Sotomayor's dissent is sort of saying we really learned powerful lessons from the nation's and the court's experience resisting and overturning laws discriminating on the basis of race. And that the commitments in those cases are deep and broad commitments to equality among persons. And those commitments in the context of this new case, Sotomayor thinks, should have led the court to recognize that the ban on gender-affirming care for transgender youth from Tennessee and presumably elsewhere those laws are inconsistent with those equality principles that the court's race equality decisions really helped us to better understand.
All right, we're going to leave it there. That was Ohio State University Law Professor Mark Spindelman. Mark, thank you for joining me today.
Thank you for having me.
Coming up, we're going to talk about what these decisions mean for young people here in Ohio. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
These days, there's so much news, it can be hard to keep up with what it all means for you, your family, and your community. The Consider This podcast from NPR features our award-winning journalism. 6 days a week, we bring you a deep dive on a news story and provide the context and analysis that helps you make sense of the news. We get behind the headlines. We get to the truth. Listen to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. The recently announced decisions from the Supreme Court in Mahmoud v. Taylor and U.S. v. Scarametti could lead to significant changes for young people across the country. In the Mahmoud case, the court said religious parents can pull their children from class if a lesson uses an LGBTQ-themed story. In the Scarametti case, the court upheld laws that ban gender-affirming medical care for transgender minors in Tennessee. Ohio passed a ban on gender-affirming care for minors last year. That ban was halted by the courts, but things could change after this recent Supreme Court decision. We're discussing what these rulings could mean for the Buckeye State and the kids that live here. Joining me now is Amanda Erickson, Senior Associate Director of Programs and Operations at Kaleidoscope Youth Center, an organization that provides aid to LGBTQ youth in Columbus. Amanda, welcome to All Sides.
Thanks for having me.
So the U.S. Supreme Court cases that I mentioned, we talked about in detail earlier in the show, but the one related to the case in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. Right now, the Supreme Court has ruled that Tennessee's ban on gender-affirming care for minors can remain. What does that mean for Ohio from your perspective?
In the immediate future, it doesn't necessarily affect Ohio because Ohio's ban on gender-affirming care is in the Ohio courts right now. Mm-hmm. However, there's always a chance that, you know, what the Supreme Court of the U.S. is saying sets a legal precedent for other, you know, fights in other places. This doesn't mean that, you know, the folks that are fighting that ban are going to stop fighting. They're absolutely going to keep going. And their fights are based on other specific legal intricacies that will keep going within the state courts.
So it's working through the courts right now. Mm-hmm. Ohio's ban right now is on hold. But if the ban in Ohio were reinstated, What would that mean for youth who you see at the Kaleidoscope Youth Center?
So the ban is held up in courts, but for the most part, hospitals have already stopped providing gender-affirming care to minors unless they were grandfathered in. Mm-hmm. So that means if a young person was accessing hormones, puberty suppression before the ban went into place, they can continue accessing that care. But hospitals right now, for the most part, are not taking on new patients, which is really unfortunate. Mm-hmm. So what we see at Kaleidoscope Youth Center is young people who have grown up in a time in the U.S. that it felt more like trans folks were going to be able to exist fully and authentically out in public, legally. And they're suddenly being told, nope, not anymore. We're kind of going back in time a bit. They grew up thinking, you know, when I hit puberty, I will be able to access these hormones, this medication to make sure that, you know, I can become the person that I want to be, that I've been, you know, meant to be my whole life. And now they can't access that. And that's really hard for those young people.
Right now, there's about 25 states who do have bans on gender affirming care, and then 25 states that don't. So we're like half and half here in the country. A lot of the bans are tied up in court, as we said. But do you hear about any individuals who want to travel to another state or move?
Absolutely. Yep. We have. I have heard about folks that are going to some of our neighboring states in the Midwest to access care and medication while still living in Ohio. They'll just travel, you know, out of state to get that care. I've also heard about families moving to places like New York to be able to have that permanent access for their young folks. I also am starting to hear about folks traveling out of the country, which is really interesting. So folks are going to places like Europe, like Canada, where they, you know, can access the care now, and they don't anticipate it necessarily being as much of a problem in the future, which isn't necessarily a guarantee in some of our other states.
Now, it remains to be seen exactly how this ruling, which is based on a Tennessee case, will impact the 25 other states that I mentioned. We have to all those cases have to work their way through the court on their own merits of that court case. But the average 13-year-old who visits the Kaleidoscope Youth Center, are they paying attention to a Supreme Court case out of Tennessee?
They are paying attention to an extent. I think 2024 moving into 2025, a trend that we've been seeing among the youth coming to our center is that they're really using the center as their safe space to get away from it all. Mm-hmm. We have advocacy programs. We do civic engagement activities with our youth. And there are some nights that they are just not into it because, you know, they are seeing the news around them. They're seeing vitriol on social media. They're getting bullied in school. Like, Kaleidoscope is the place that they get to come and not have their identity be the most important thing about them, and to be able to just be a young person and not pay as much attention. So I think they do know what's going on. They know specifically what's going on in Ohio as it pertains to them as individuals and what they are and are not allowed to do. A lot of them are paying close attention to their school boards because school boards individually are creating policies that are affecting LGBTQ youth in positive and negative ways. But, you know, they come to KYC to not talk about it, to not, you know, have to deep dive into it every time.
And earlier in the hour, we were talking with law professor Mark Spindleman, and he was equating some of these cases related to transgender youth and or transgender people in general. He was equating it to race relations, where he said that it took 10 to 20 years for some of the law litigation to catch up with different parts of equality in the United States. That's hard to explain to a 12-year-old that they might have to wait 10 to 20 years for laws to catch up.
It definitely is. I think, you know, one of the things we have going for us at Kaleidoscope is our staff is nearly entirely LGBTQ, and we have quite a few trans folks on staff who are trans adults that our young people can look up to. And it was a very different time to be a trans teenager 15, 20 years ago than it is today. And we're kind of going back to that. So we have, you know, the personal historical knowledge for folks to be able to say, like, hey, this is what I had access to and didn't have access to. Here's how I navigated it. And here I am as a successful trans adult living life. It's really important for our young people to see that representation in real life and to be able to, you know, hold on to that hope for the future.
What do you see about this idea? Because the two court cases we're talking about this hour also involve parental rights. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that you see people come to the Kaleidoscope Youth Center who have the support of their parents and others that don't.
Yep.
How do you see parental rights playing a role in here on whether parents have the right over their children?
I think that's a really, really interesting question. When we are looking at...
And you're glad you're not a lawyer.
I am.
Yeah.
When we're looking at both of the cases that we're here to talk about today, one of them, the Scrimeti case, is taking freedom away from parents of trans youth to be able to provide access to care to their young folks. And one of them is giving parents all of the control to determine what their young people are seeing in the classroom. And I think those are contradictory. And I'm not sure, you know, how we help people define what their fight is really about when parents' rights is being just kind of the name and title slapped onto things. I do think it's important to understand that so many parents of young trans folks are supportive and want to help their children grow into successful and thriving adolescents and young adults. And they can do that through providing access to healthcare to their children, and they should have a right to do that.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about how recent Supreme Court decisions could impact LGBTQ youth in Ohio with Amanda Erickson, Senior Associate Director of Programs and Operations at Kaleidoscope Youth Center, an organization that provides aid to LGBTQ youth in Columbus. I want to pivot to the other case that we were highlighting this hour, Mahmoud v. Taylor. In this case, a divided Supreme Court said that religious parents can pull their children from class if a lesson uses an LGBTQ-themed story. Do you feel like this decision could have an impact on school curriculum in Ohio?
I do. You know, we already have opt-out policies in a lot of places in Ohio for parents to be able to remove their students from sex ed classes or sexuality-focused units in certain classes. I think, you know, those types of things have been around for a long time. And generally in recent history, those have been the only topics that parents are really pulling their kids from.
Mm-hmm.
I think when we start talking about the curriculum that the Mahmoud case was specifically about, which was LGBTQ related storybooks in the elementary classroom. We have to consider LGBTQ inclusion and representation to be about a celebration of all of the different people in our community, a celebration of all of the different family structures in our classroom. And we're essentially, you know, telling young people with two moms or a transgender parent, right? Like, you don't get to see your family represented in the books that we're reading in school. Or maybe we are reading these books in school and some of your classmates are going to leave because maybe it's not okay for their families. That's a terrible message to be sending to our really young students. And I think we need full representation of all different identities in all of our curriculum so that people grow up understanding that the whole world out there is different, right? That everyone is not necessarily having the same beliefs and opinions as their own family. And that's what makes it cool to exist in the U.S.
Now, this Mahmoud case dates back to 2022. The district added these lessons because they wanted to talk about the diversity in their district. They wanted to teach students about the diversity within their student population. But since 2022, a lot has happened when it comes to DEI policies. Mm-hmm. Those programs are being pulled back for various reasons due to executive orders at the federal level. So do you think that this case would even exist now in 2025? Do you feel like those books are being pulled anyway?
I think it depends on where you are.
Mm-hmm.
And I think even if we think about it at the state level, right, Ohio is a local control state. So school boards get to decide what's going on in their school districts, right? The state is not necessarily deciding each time, although it's doing more of that in recent years. There are definitely book bans in some of our school districts in Ohio. A lot of them are about young adult novels that maybe folks think are, you know, too graphic. Sometimes they are about those elementary storybooks that bring in an LGBTQ character. However, those book bans are usually coming from the community, and they're at the school board level. And so there are so many different, you know, districts and folks out there that I think it would still be happening. We also have something similar to this in Ohio with last year's House Bill 8, which removed some sexuality instruction from the K-3 classroom. And didn't totally define what sexuality instruction meant towards the beginning, but we've taken it to mean, you know, any reference to LGBTQ characters, books, content at all. So in Ohio, you know, this might not necessarily have come up because we already have our own kind of rules against this kind of instruction.
We have less than a minute left, but do you feel like, are there any alternative ways to help spread awareness about LGBTQ issues that you'd like to talk about that maybe would not turn into a court case?
You know, I think it's really important if you're a parent listening to this, that your children have access to materials that represent all different people. And we're talking about LGBTQ identities, racial identities, religious identities. It's so imperative that our young people are learning about all of the different people around them. And we can do that at home just as easily as we can do at school. The public libraries are a great place to start. Your youth services librarians and teen services librarians, like, they are there to help find that material for you. Mm-hmm. And we need to make that happening in our own homes as well.
We've been speaking with Amanda Erickson, Senior Associate Director of Programs and Operations at the Kaleidoscope Youth Center, an organization that provides aid to LGBTQ youth in Columbus. Thanks for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and I want to say thank you to student producer Chris Corcoran, who produced this hour. This is 89.7 NPR News. I'm Amy Jurevich.